those search lights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM 92.1 FM in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb and welcome to Community Spotlight. Each week I try and bring somebody in or an organisation to talk about their events or their journeys, and I've invited again Jen Hamilton into the studio. Hi Jen.
Hey Herb, how's it going?
I'm very well. How's yourself?
I'm a little bit sleepy today. I think end of the year's caught up with me.
Oh, that's no good. But you're heading off for Christmas break?
Yes.
Off to Queensland?
Queensland and Wollongong.
Oh, that'll be good. Wollongong to your mum?
To my mum.
Yes, I've talked to your mum.
I know.
after our last conversation. And our last conversation was about the weathering together for the 14th Black Gully Festival.
Yes, we had a stall at the Black Gully Festival connected to the exhibition at NERAM, How to Weather Together.
And that's in the Mazda room. Now, it's still running?
It's on until the 1st of February.
1st of February, nice. Mm. So people have got time to get back into it, have a look at
Actually, yeah, and I've been saying to people, and this is sort of part of the exhibition, it's in a nice, cool gallery. And if you're, you know, on a hot, we've got a heat wave coming up the next few days. If you need to take some shelter in the middle of the day, it's a lovely thing to do, to go into the gallery and sit around. There's even some activities you can do and participate in the exhibition directly.
So we'll get onto that in a minute. But I always find if there's a exhibition that I go to that has a lot of content, it needs at least two trips. So you see stuff and you come home and you go, oh, I might actually, I'd miss that bit, and I go back and have a second trip.
Mm-hmm.
So don't be embarrassed if you have to go back for a second visit or a third visit.
You hear about sort of museum fatigue if you're going travelling or something. I'm tired by the time I get out of the first room. It's like there's so many ideas just in one work of art. Anyway.
February?
The 1st of February.
So what sort of response have you had both at Black Gully? So do you get a lot of people through at Black Gully?
Yeah, we had some workshops at Black Gully Festival, which were really... And we also had tarot reading by Piers Kelly, who's a local. The stall had a weathering workshop where we did this thing called Lucky Dip, which you can actually do in the exhibition. And it's a bunch of cards. One encourages you to think imaginatively about your body, and the other makes you think about how, like, an embodied way about your imagination. It's kind of, they go both ways in relation to the weather. And you pull out the cards and the card might say something like, you know, where is the weather in the room? And you have to kind of think about it, or hold out your hand, can you feel the weather? It's kind of just a provocation to start to attune you to the weather a bit differently. And that was quite fun. And then we had a workshop by an artist called Ubhavaka, Rest Your Identity, which was about sort of just letting go of certain parts of yourself and welcoming them back in kindly. And I think part of the weathering work and why this Yu's work was relevant is that it's about sort of existential weathering as much as it is about rain, thunder, lightning and sunshine. And so that workshop really did some of that work on the self. And also we had Canadian artist Nina Vroman, this beautiful workshop called Learning to Scry with the Sky, where we walked up Black Gully and she gave us a bunch of methods for reading our fortunes in the clouds using these cute little mirrors. It was very magical.
Oh, very nice. So the feedback so far from people that have visited the exhibition, what have they said?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I used to be involved in theatre, right, and you get an immediate response like laughter or applause, whereas you put up an exhibition and you don't get the same kind of immediate feedback. But one of the things about this exhibition is there is a participatory element where people can go in and do activities and pin them up on the wall. And I've had to restock all of the paper, and there's a beautiful kind of exhibition emerging within the exhibition, which actually makes me feel like people are engaging really nicely with the work. And there was actually on Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down Armadale, a comment from someone who was like, I don't usually like what's on at NERAM, but the exhibitions that are there at the moment are great. So that's kind of neat.
Well, I think that's a good opportunity to do something similar next Black Gully Festival.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I want to do my stall more. Actually, I'm going to do the stall again on the Moore Markets on the 25th of January.
Oh, nice. While we talk about the Black Gully, let's talk about your partner, Craig, the bass guitarist in the Rocky Bottom Girls.
Woo!
So he's come out of his shell a little bit. He's now vocal.
He was playing guitar on
this. Yeah, and songwriting.
Yes.
So it's always exciting when somebody who hasn't done much or you haven't seen much come out and do some songwriting.
Yeah, I mean, okay, well, I mean, I can talk about it from my perspective, but Craig listens to a lot of music, plays a lot of music, can draw, like he's a very creative person, and he had this amazing kind of burst of inspiration over the last 6 months and wrote like a whole string of songs about, like, what was really interesting about his songs is they're all about quite diverse things. Like, one's about a werewolf and one's about his dad and one's about a guy named Hayden Pentecost who got really, really high on a budget airline and just like went crazy up in the air and ended up going to jail. And it's kind of this like hilarious song calling for his freedom because he just had a bad day at work. Yeah, he's just like, it's kind of a creative, imaginative type of songwriting. So it's like been a really nice aspect of himself that I've been able to witness coming out.
Oh, very nice. So he does try the songs on your kids and you at home?
Oh, yeah. No, it's really cool. Like, he'll go out to the back room and work on it. And, like, even I think he texts the song lyrics to himself on his phone. And then eventually the song will kind of come together and he'll put the music together and then we'll get the sort of the early version of it.
Well, it's all been recorded at the radio station here and we've got a podcast that will, a three-part podcast of the whole day that'll be up on our website pretty soon, maybe in the new year for Christmas, and we'll be able to hear the Rocky Bottoms and all the other artists and all the whole day on the podcast.
Oh, that's awesome.
I've already had a listen. It's quite good.
Great.
Well, while we're talking about exciting things, you went down to Rising Tide.
Yes, what a time.
Rising Tide at Newcastle, that was blocking the port of Newcastle.
Yes.
So tell me about, just briefly, about Rising Tide and why you went.
Well, Rising Tide's been going for, I should know exactly how long, but quite a while. And it's called a protestival. So it's a festival and a protest. And why I went is that we try a lot to get action on climate change. And, you know, my work is related to that and it's very sort of gentle and, you know, it invites like self-reflection and like slow transformation. But there is also a really serious climate emergency. And although I don't like to live in this kind of antagonistic state all the time, I do actually think that going to a protest and standing up for what you believe in and also kind of like displaying the fact that a lot of people want action on climate change is really important, because otherwise I think politicians and business people can think, oh, people don't care. And so I think Rising Tide like really works that idea well. Like it's such a symbolic site, like so much coal. Like if you drive down the New England Highway to Sydney, you just see the coal trains like full, like literally pulling coal out of the earth and taking it to the port. And so having people kind of block the port, you know, it's not like we're blocking the port for a super long time, but it's like an important thing to try to disrupt the flow of coal and the flow of profit that's destroying the planet.
Very well said. I did have a bit of a chat with Bar Finch last week.
Yes.
And she went down.
Yes, she did. We have a birthday close to each other and sometimes share a cake.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
But what she told me, which I didn't realise, that the origin of Rising Tide was from a group of younger people that got together. It wasn't older people who had time in their hands to actually, you know, make a statement and protest. It was basically, it's been forged by younger generation.
Yeah, super. I saw the film that was made as well. So I should have known exactly how old it was. Yeah, but definitely the young generation that's concerned about their future. And rightly so. Like, we've already seen in our lifetimes sort of significant change. Like, I think in Armidale, the coming week, we've got a string of days over 30. And the average, I think, temperature for Armidale is like maximum of 15 days over 30. And we're probably already at 15 days, you know, well over 15 days for this year. So I think we're seeing that kind of subtle climate change happening in Armidale every year.
No, we can see the extremes that we've had, certainly. There's plenty of evidence out there. So let's go back to the more formal part, interesting stuff out of the way.
I just do want to say rising tide's really fun, and we had a high country group go down, and we're going to do it again next year. So if anyone's listening and wants to join, reach out.
Is it through Sustainable Living Armidale?
I think you can connect up with the group through Sustainable Living Armidale, so look on the website.
Okay, let's move to feminism now. Dr. Jennifer Hamilton.
Yes.
Of UNE's Humanities, Art and Social Science School.
Yes.
Your PhD was down in Sydney?
I did it at UNSW in the School of, I think it was probably then called the School of Arts and Media, SAM.
So, and that PhD was about a storm?
The storm in Shakespeare's King Lear. Weather. You can see this theme. My exhibition is weather. I've got nothing else. All I talk about is the weather. It's so boring.
So how does that relate to your interest in climate change and weather?
There is a link. That's a great question. I wanted to look at the history of the representation of weather, but I had a very, like, at that time, it was just a very sort of broad sense that I wanted to talk about that I didn't have a really clear focus. And my supervisor was a Shakespearean. His name was Richard Madeline. He's passed away. He actually passed away towards the end of my PhD, which was really sad. And, you know, I was like, oh, well, I'll start by looking at the weather in Shakespeare because Shakespeare is notoriously weathery. There's lots of storms and shipwrecks and, you know, shipwrecks that start plays, particularly a lot of the comedies start with a shipwreck wrecking the characters on the kind of island, and then the mistaken identity drama plays out, and then you have The Tempest at the end of his career where he kind of draws on that, but it's a lot darker and more sinister. But yeah, King Lear is the kind of most major storm in his body of work. It was a really great project, and I feel really fortunate to have done my PhD when I did, because I think there was a lot of freedom to just explore and trust the process and not have to anticipate what you were doing. And what kind of emerged was a study of embodied vulnerability of kings. So I'll unpack what I mean by that. It's like, you know, the king, and the reason this is a tragedy is the king's old in King Lear and he wants to give up ruling, but he doesn't want to give anything up. And he wants to, like, divide the kingdom and be looked after in his old age. It's a very understandable thing, and we need to care better for the elderly. But at the same time, because he's a character, we don't need to just think about him as a human. We can think about him as a symbol for power. And a king is a powerful individual who is kind of obliged by virtue of his role to be invulnerable, right? To be powerful, to represent the kind of immortal sovereign state and the kingdom. And he kind of takes this on, King Lear, almost psychologically, right? It's like he has to be invulnerable. And this storm, which kind of is often read as a metaphor for his madness, actually, I think when you read it really carefully and closely, is this study in that reckoning with what it means to actually be a vulnerable living animal who's forced for their whole life to pretend to be invulnerable. And I think we see this in politics today, you know, like the way that people have to perform a certain kind of invulnerability is actually really damaging for our society. And so this is where that was what it ended up being about, even though I was wanting to write about the weather.
So does that, from what I get from that, is more of a masculine, the whole King Lear thing, a very masculine view of how he wanted to stay in power?
Yeah, masculinity. I think that we see in the way that we think about gender, we're jumping ahead to talking about feminism, I guess. The way that we think about gender is kind of the masculine archetype is kind of strong and powerful and maybe unemotional and, yeah, invulnerable and protecting and can kind of provide for the family, like all of these things. And, you know, feminine is kind of the caring and nurturing, but also like physically weaker and emotionally kind of chaotic and all of these things, like this kind of gender binary plays out in our lives and in our culture. And I think definitely when it comes to like a king, that kind of masculine archetype is embedded in it. And you see also it's a very gendered play as well, because King Lear has three daughters and there's this kind of expectation that the daughters will treat him in a certain way. and, you know, we can have an argument about the daughters and King Lear maybe another day.
Yes, but we've certainly seen the horrible side of politics and how groups of men act towards each other and how they've actually acted with female members of Parliament. So that's been a very disappointing thing for me to see in the way Parliament has acted. But let's just jump into feminism.
Yes.
I think it was a good segue. So I don't know much about feminism. All I know is we've got the first wave, which was the suffragettes, but that was more about the women's right to vote, and that was in the early 1903, 1906. There was a book in 1960 called The Second Sex, and that was about the disparity between men and women, and that was in the 60s, that second wave in movement. But where have we come now from the 60s to now?
It's a long
time. But what have we got? And maybe let's talk about eco-feminism as well, because that's sort of, I think you've got a bit of a vibe going there.
Yeah, gosh, there's so much that we could talk about. And I'm like, where do I start? I'm going to start with kind of the question of thinking about feminism not as a disembodied idea, but as something that emerged, you know, and even I think in the early writings of people like Mary Wollstonecraft, it's like an emerges from everyday life and experience, maybe some degree of dissatisfaction and curiosity about whether or not things could be better. And I think, like, in the history of humanity, like, to go even bigger than just from 1960 to the present day, we are kind of constantly trying to ask that question, like, how can the world be better? How could life not be as miserable? How can we end suffering? And I think that the history of feminism is not distinct from that general desire for things to be better. So I think I wanted to kind of start there. Then I think when you look at how that plays out historically, it kind of emerges from what's going on in the world at the time. And, you know, like you mentioned, the suffragettes, it's like, okay, we have these democracies where people are allowed to vote, but only, well, not even 50% of the population is allowed to vote initially, right? So it's like, okay, so would it be better actually if more people could vote? Like, does it actually make the society more democratic? In my discipline and training in literary studies, you see this history of writing that is, until recently, like heavily skewed towards men, because men could write because they had education, they had free time. We have this great essay by Virginia Woolf from the early 20th century, A Room of One's Own, which is like the reason why women can't write or don't write as much as men is not because they can't write or they're stupid or whatever. It's just that they don't have any time or freedom or money to do that. And so her argument in that essay is we need a room of one's own for, you know, to have the time to write. And, you know, Woolf was lucky that she had kind of a wealthy husband and grew up in a particular time where that was available to her, but it's not available to everyone. So in writing, right? So you also see that inequity play out in the history of literature. Shakespeare was a man. I'm not going to get into the authorship stuff around Shakespeare. There's like, I think there is one of the authorship, like maybe it was a woman, maybe it was Shakespeare's wife who wrote all the plays. You know, we have this kind of canon which is heavily skewed towards men for those reasons. And so you get, to go back to kind of the 1960s, a bunch of women who are now a little bit more empowered because of access to work, paid work, because of access to university education, that are starting to write and starting to write about their experience and write about their desires. And the people that I might pick up on first, even though I'm, you know, going to be cherry picking like quite specifically, and there's going to be so much I leave out of this story, are the French feminists, people like not Simone de Beauvoir, like she's a little bit earlier than who I'm talking about, but Luce Irigaray and Hélène Cixous, and they start to write about writing itself in the 70s and say that, you know, not only are women oppressed kind of, you know, because they don't have access to education or that free time to read and write and think, actually the language does a disservice to their experience. So this kind of 60s and 70s French philosophy was all about trying to find what they called écriture féminine. I'm not a French speaker, but it's like women's writing, like a writing that is actually correspondent with women's experience. And that was, I think, a really important moment in as part of the second wave. It's not the sort of second wave that you associate with, I guess, like bra burning and, you know, like those kind of stereotypical ideas about what feminism is. It was quite a subtle moment in the second wave, but a really important gesture to getting us to think about how language itself actually has within it all of the kind of hierarchies and binaries that play out in society.
Well, you've taken us to the 70s now.
Yeah.
So let's just jump into ecofeminism.
Yeah, great.
And maybe some of those ethical issues around feminism and how feminism may improve the way or be a catalyst to improve the way the society acts.
Yeah, so ecofeminism, there's a bunch of different people who write on ecofeminists. One of the like key texts that summarises the movement is by an Indian feminist, Vandana Shiva, who I don't know if you've heard of Vandana Shiva, her, but she also kind of is really interested in seed sovereignty and kind of local farming and agriculture, and Maria Myers. And they were writing from a post-colonial feminist perspective and kind of looking at how the way that nature or the environment, the non-human world, is treated is similarly kind of denigrated to the way that women are treated, like and that bodies are treated in the world. And so there's this kind of an ecofeminist desire to say that we need to like treat women better, but we also need to treat nature better. And we need to kind of like build up sort of, it's not just about equality between a male and a female sex or a masculine and a feminine gender. It's about something kind of more holistic than that. It's about gender, it's about nature. But it's also, in the context of post-colonial feminism, about kind of race and kind of the racialization of the world through that colonial process and the resistance to that through the post-colonial process, but also about money, right? Like, and you see kind of oppression playing out in colonial places, like India, for example. The exploitation of the land was kind of for the profit of
England.
Yeah. And so ecofeminism sort of had this very holistic vision of what the feminist project was about, right? It wasn't just about that, what I was saying at the start, like I would like my life to be better in this household. It was kind of like we kind of need to make the whole world kind of better.
So I suppose when I think about that, I think if we're treating Mother Earth, and it's called Mother Earth for a reason, if we treat Mother Earth more kindly, we might actually also treat each other more kindly.
Well, that's the idea, Herb.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm not being facetious. I think that there is something really quite simple at the heart of this, you know, that care actually is central. There's in the, oh my God, my dates, I think it's 1975, we're in the 70s again, a movement in Europe, particularly called Wages for Housework, led by a feminist called Silvia Federici. And that was the idea that basically if care labour were to be charged like a wage, the whole economy would basically fall apart because the economy runs on unwaged care work. And although Federici in her pamphlets, they're really short, you can Google them and read them on the internet, says things like, you know, I don't really want to, you know, I'm not trying to turn my care labour into a way of a money-making scheme. I'm actually just trying to point out that our economy, like, really runs on this labour. What would it look like if we were to value care differently? And I think that that kind of care for people and care for place is also at the heart of that. Like, you see today, it's not very lucrative to be an environmentalist, to work in the community garden like Joe Leone does. Like, you don't get paid for that, but you spend kind of hours and hours doing really important caring for place, for plants, and also in the context of a community garden, like the community around the garden for each other. And, you know, you can't make a fortune off that, but you can actually have a better life.
Yeah, I think in my career, I've seen basically certain on the Western Plains, the control and conquering of nature for economic return was the big driver. And unfortunately, we've lost so many species and so many habitats as a result of that approach to, as I said, control and conquer nature.
I really like talking about feminism itself like this and trying to map sort of a path through the history of feminism. But, you know, in my work, it's absolutely central and also in the background at the same time. Like, my object is not just to talk about women. I'm interested in what feminism can kind of do for everybody. Actually, to jump forward to the year 2000, African-American feminist Bell Hooks wrote a book called Feminism is for Everybody. And so, you know, there's this idea that we think about feminism as just being for women. But that also is kind of saying, well, everyone, you know, there's either men or women, there's no other genders. And we know that there are cultures that are not settler Australian culture, like colonial culture from England, but cultures from indigenous cultures here and around the world that had more than two genders. And then we also have kind of like transgender people and non-binary people and people who identify in all different ways, right? So people are trying to kind of diversify their gender expression in the present, as well as there being a history of a lot more gender diversity than just men and women, globally speaking. And so for me, feminism is sort of like, what does feminism add to that desire for everybody, in the words of Bell Hooks, to be, have a better life? And that this, like, that men actually can benefit, like men, and I mean like men, you know, King Lear, could benefit from this project, even though it's seen as a kind of us and them project. If you're open to the provocation of feminism, I think, about being in our bodies, about caring for each other, about trying to build a better world towards a kind of more equitable world from that place, then surely everybody stands to benefit in the long term.
So I might just add to that first statement from what you just said. So we need to care for our Mother Earth, treat each other more kindly and with more recognition. And that recognition encompasses the whole gender scope that we've been talking about.
Mm.
Now, there is a course. It's called Approaches to Gender Theory and Practical Applications. That's at UNE?
Yes. So I teach this course. It's in sociology. And I think actually you can just do one-off courses at UNE. You don't have to be enrolled in a full bachelor degree. Or you can do just a graduate diploma or something kind of small. Or you can do it at a master's coursework level. But it's a course that I teach with Dr. Christina Kenny and Dr. Felicity Joseph. And Felicity is a philosopher by training. And actually she's written a book on Simone de Beauvoir. And Christina is a sociologist who's done a lot of work in Kenya on regional communities in Kenya and gender politics of those communities, and also does a lot of work now on fisheries in Samoa and climate change, so kind of in an eco-feminist space. And that course is focused on how to weave thinking about gender and embodiment through all types of knowledge, right? Because it's not that, like, gender is everywhere. Like, everything is gendered, really. You go to the toilets, they're gendered. You go to the airport, you know, if you are flagged for carrying something illicit, you get pat down by a woman or pat down by a man, right? You know, it's like the world is kind of like gendered in this way. The way that we dress, like, you go to the shops, there's the men's section and the women's section, and, you know, it's just all super gendered. And so that plays out then in every part of, like, society. So if you're a psychologist training, you need to learn how to think about the gendered experience, right? It's not a universal experience. It's like we're brought up kind of differently if we're gendered, or if we have different genitals. And obviously some people try to push back against that, right? You raise people and try not to, like, really project gender onto them or dress them in really girly clothes or boy clothes if you're parenting in a sort of gender-neutral way. But the world genders children as well, right? It's a lot to push back against. It's not just something we have ourselves. We're read as gendered people. Like, I don't know, people probably say, call you a he and call me a she because of the way that we look. I do use she, they pronouns, right? So I don't mind being called they. I actually, if someone called me a he, I'd be kind of curious about it, but that's another story as well. But it's like gender's not something that we just own in our bodies. It's something that is the way that the world is organized. Anyway, I'm getting back to this unit. The unit is about methods for applying thinking about gender to all sorts of different areas of study. So it's a sociology unit in its coding, but we would love people who are studying medicine or psychology or even agriculture or business to come and do the unit to just help to think about the way that gender works in our society. And also with this little kind of provocation from the start of the conversation, it was like, if we think about gender in this critical way, but also in a, you know, in a slightly speculative way, like how could we make experience better for everyone? Yeah. And so the unit is, yeah, it's kind of a nuts and bolts unit in that regard.
Well, it sounds very interesting. I think there's so much to talk about. Maybe we need to scope out some specific things for next time and do a part B on feminism.
Great.
And I think it'll be great. Thanks for coming in and talking on Spotlight. It's been a bit of a hoot. Enjoy your Christmas.
Thanks so much, Herb.
And I think thanks very much for what you did at Black Galley Festival 2025. And I look forward to more of Craig's songwriting.
Yes.
And more feminism talk next year.
I hope so. I'd love to know if anyone listened and what they thought and if they have any, dare I say, questions.
Well, let's try and find some for next year. That's a good thing to finish on. And that's Community Spotlight. Thank you, Dr. Jennifer Hamilton from UNE.
Thanks, Herb.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM 92.1 FM in the car and at work for great tunes and community news.